Oh, right. Daryl Cherney and Xerox the Money. And, well, I think my guest with me today, Derek Creston, may understand that sentiment. Derek, hello there.
Hi, great to be with you.
Oh, great to be with you, Derek. And Derek is with Common Cause. He is the Regional Director of State Operations for the Western States.
That's right.
And well, what does that entail? Being the regional director, what do you get to do?
Well, Common Cause is a nonpartisan citizens organization that works on holding government accountable, and I've been working with our state chapters across the West on a new campaign that we're calling Amend 2012. That is aimed at reversing a Supreme Court ruling that has unleashed all of this corporate money into our political process.
Yes, we've seen the result. And in terms of how did you get into this area, into politics and especially into the whole election and election finance business?
Well, I've you know, had a long-standing interest in protecting our environment, and as I started looking at those issues, I realized that one of the things that was holding back both our state government and our national government from taking sensible decisions to protect the public health and things like that was the incredible influence of coal companies, of oil companies, and other corporations on our political process that they get through spending this money that they get from consumers and they get from shareholders and they use it to spend directly against our own interests in influencing our government. And that's what strikes me as wrong.
Yeah, just looking at that big picture, basically, where you see it all going, it's just not going into the right places.
Yeah.
Cause. Now, who is actually involved in getting this, getting the whole Mend 2012 campaign going?
Well, there are really thousands of citizens across the country that have risen up in response to this Supreme Court action that has, you know, essentially declared that corporations have the same constitutional rights as real people do, and that spending an unlimited amount of money on political campaigns is the same thing as free speech. So Common Cause is the organization that has launched this Amend 2012 campaign, but we're working with other organizations and just with individual citizens all over the country to find a way to push back against that decision and try to take back our government.
Right. And how will you be getting this out? What methods and approach are you going to use?
Well, we think that the best thing for citizens to do in response to the court's actions is to put advisory questions on state ballots and local ballots, giving regular voters a chance to weigh in. You know, do you agree that corporations are people, and do you agree that there should be no limits on political spending? And we think that will pressure the United States Congress to propose a constitutional amendment that would reverse the courts and clearly establish that corporations are not people, and that we need a level playing field in politics and sensible limits on the amount of money that people spend.
Right. Now, will be this one of those things where if that occurs, will it then go eventually go back to the Supreme Court again, even if, say, it gets through the Congress? I don't know if you want to look that far, but would that be the way you would see it going?
Well, no. The process for amending the Constitution is it goes through the Congress and then it goes out to the states, actually, to ratify. You need three-quarters of the states to ratify a constitutional amendment. But this is really the only way that we, the people, have to trump the Supreme Court or to overturn the Supreme Court. But once you clearly spell out the U.S. Constitution, you've then gone over the heads of the United States Supreme Court and taken away their ability to interpret things as they want to based on their own ideologies.
And basically this all stemmed, I mean, there's a long history, but this recent fiasco really stems from the Citizens United versus the FCC in 2010. Can you tell us something about what happened in that situation?
Yeah, that's what's really has sparked this movement. And in the Citizens United versus FEC ruling, the Supreme Court in essence said that corporations can spend as much money as they want to influence our federal election campaigns. And so they struck down bans on the use of corporate money in our elections. And that's what's led to the creation of all these super PACs that we've been seeing here in the presidential race and we'll see next fall in our elections for Congress in the United States Senate.
I read somewhere that there are over 300 super PACs, political action committees. What are they, and what, you know, what is that amorphous thing called a super PAC? Why is it different from a PAC?
A regular federal PAC is something that gives money directly to candidates for Congress or presidency, but they can only accept contributions of up to $5,000. A super PAC is basically just a loophole around that rule, and instead of giving the money directly to a candidate, they simply buy their own ads. And by doing that, they can accept an unlimited amount of money. And in fact, I just saw today a stat that 80% of the funds going into these super PACs have come from just 196 very wealthy individuals,
Wow.
Giving more than $100,000 each. So it's really opened up an opportunity for the super rich to have an inordinate amount of influence on our presidential race and our upcoming congressional elections.
Interesting that 1% is battling back through that.
Yeah, it's even smaller than the 1% versus the 99%, but it's absolutely a tool for them to battle back against the rest of us.
Interesting. And of course, the funny side of it a couple of weeks ago was the Stephen Colbert on the Comedy Central actually getting a super PAC together and actually getting money and showing how farcical it was, the rules that don't seem to be there about intermingling between the campaign and the super PACs.
Yeah, he's done an excellent job just pointing out how absurd the logic of the Supreme Court has gotten, where they're pretending that there's no coordination going on between these super PACs and the candidates, even though the super PACs are usually run by like a former staffer of the candidate. And so he pointed that out by giving control of his super PAC to his good friend, Jon Stewart from The Daily Show. And they just, it's kind of pathetic that they've been able to make such a mockery out of our federal campaign finance laws, because they really are laughable right now.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if the Supreme Court are embarrassed or who is, but somebody should be.
You know, they absolutely should be embarrassed. And the new development today is that the Supreme Court has put the kibosh on a law in Montana that's been on the books for 100 years, banning corporate laws in their state elections there. But two justices, Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, are saying, you know, look, we should look at the evidence over these 100 years and use that as an opportunity to review the decision we made in Citizens United. So there are at least some justices that are pointing out that it's kind of crazy that we've gotten to where things are, and they're wanting to take another look.
Oh, good, good. Excellent. And now you bring up something interesting. What is the difference between federal, state, and local funding for political campaigns? How is that all sifted out and kept separate, or is it not?
Well, the rules for running for president and running for the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives are set at the federal level. And, you know, right now there are limits on contributions to candidates for Congress, and there's actually a ban on corporate contributions going directly to members of Congress. but there are no limits whatsoever on what either individuals or corporations can spend independently of that. Now, the rules for state candidates, so, you know, in California, those rules are set by the legislature in Sacramento as well as by the voter initiative process. And in each state, they go about setting their own rules for governor and their state legislature separately.
The biggest issues is that the information isn't there of people who are donating. And I understand that the information is there. It's just very hard to get to. Is that the case, or how is it being shielded?
Well, sometimes the information is there, but it comes up rather late. The Supreme Court did say they didn't have any problem with requiring disclosure of these super large contributions coming from billionaires and corporations, but Congress has not followed up with legislation that requires that disclosure, or at least not requiring it on a very frequent basis. So we did see at the end of January some filings coming out on these super PACs. But that was, of course, after there'd already been caucuses in Iowa and, you know, the primaries in New Hampshire. So some of that was coming after the fact. And the other problem is that corporations and billionaires are sometimes hiding their money by giving it through nonprofit entities that don't have to disclose the source of their funds. All you see is the name of the nonprofit showing up in the disclosure form, such as American Crossroads or Americans for Prosperity or some generic term like that.
Interesting. So, yeah, so there's a definitely a level of opaqueness there.
Yeah, so that's, you know, one immediate thing that Congress could do and should do would be to pass what's called the Federal Disclose Act that would at least improve that aspect of the problem.
Where is that in the process?
Well, you know, it had died in the Congress due to the procedural rules in the Senate in 2010, but there's it looks like going to be an effort to revive that, and we may see votes again in both the House and the Senate yet this spring, so we'll see.
I was reading some statistics, which we all know what they're like, but it's interesting. It said that 78% of people get their information, political information, from TV news. That's an incredible percentage when you think of it still.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot, and I don't really so much have a problem with the news, that if they're actually getting news from TV, but what that really translates into is then they're getting a lot of information from TV commercials that are paid for by, you know, these well-funded campaigns. And so if you're a candidate that doesn't have a lot of money to buy those commercials, you wind up not getting heard from very much. But if you're a candidate that's got loads of money and big super PACs behind you, you're getting your message out quite a bit more than the others.
Right. I think we've seen some of those, how it's already operated from Iowa through, where the negative ads have had impacts.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really gotten fairly bizarre where the entire fate of a candidate's campaign depends upon the willingness of a single donor to write a check for $5 million or $10 million as to whether or not that candidate's going to be viable. And some candidates, such as Newt Gingrich, have had that support, and other candidates haven't, and they've fallen by the wayside. What the Supreme Court has said in a series of these rulings is that some people, and really a very small group of people, less than 1% of us, can have a much larger voice than everyone else in the political process. And that's really no way to run a democracy that depends upon, you know, hearing the voice of everybody. And how can you have self-government when such a tiny group of people are the ones that get to do all the speaking?
Exactly. And nowadays, especially with so much information available, in the older days, it was much harder to get to things, but it's very little can be concealed now. I mean, eventually it's going to come out over the internet, isn't it?
Yeah, and that is part of the good news, is ordinary people, I think, have a better opportunity to get their voices heard through the internet, through, you know, writing blogs or doing social networking or posting their own videos or things like that. but it's still very hard for the ordinary person to compete with, a millionaire that can write a check for $5 million to a candidate and blanket the airwaves with, ads attacking somebody else.
And now that brings us to another side of things is, apart from getting the voice out on that end, voting, there's a real movement to basically make it harder for people to register vote and to vote. What's happening on that side of things?
Yeah, it's really somewhat Orwellian. You've got this group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, that receives funding from several hundred corporations, Koch Industries, ExxonMobil, entities like that. And they have been introducing legislation in states all across the country that are aimed at making the voting process much more restrictive by limiting the forms of ID that a voter can show when they go to the polls, by narrowing the opportunities to vote early or vote by mail, and just making the process more restrictive, with the eye towards making it harder for some people to vote and skewing the election results as a result.
Is that basically, you're implying that basically minorities are the most affected by this?
Yeah, that's what the numbers show, and that seems pretty clear what the intent of these laws are. I mean, they pretend that they're interested in voting integrity and voting security, but the impact of these is aimed at preventing elderly people, minority people, low-income people from having their votes counted.
Right, because
basically a new form of a poll tax.
Oh, interesting. Because it seems there isn't that many instances of voting irregularities that would merit that type of effort against it, you'd think.
Yeah, there are not many instances of it, and the places where we do find voter fraud actually wouldn't be solved by the particular remedies that they're putting forth. So it seems not really a sincere attempt to create more secure elections, but rather an attempt to keep certain people from voting.
How many people are voting by mail now in elections generally, in federal elections?
Well, the rules for that vary quite a bit by state. Now, here in California, we have a process whereby people can sign up to receive all of their ballots by mail, and it's anywhere between 40% and 60% of people in a given county are actually participating by that. So fairly high numbers here.
That is, I am really surprised. That is incredibly high. And does that have an effect, do you think, on possibly results of elections? Obviously, because conditions can change. If somebody's voted a month beforehand and something happens, obviously, between then, say, on a proposition or a candidate, that's the risk, I suppose.
Yeah, there's certainly that possibility. The other way it tends to change the dynamic of campaigns is it gives candidates a chance to respond if they get hit with a last-minute negative attack ad or mailer or something like that. You know, it used to be that things like that could come out the day before an election and there'd be no way for a candidate to respond. But now, when people are voting a week or two prior to Election Day, the attack ads are coming earlier, and that's giving candidates a chance to respond in the media, and so it's somewhat changed the dynamics of the way campaigning is working.
Oh, that's a very interesting point. It's spreading it out rather than just having it bunched at the end.
Yeah, that's right. So, I think you can say there are pros and cons to it, but it is definitely something that a lot of voters are finding is more convenient for them and something that people are signing up to do.
Very interesting. And are there any other election reforms in the offing, or any efforts being pushed to that effort?
Well, one of the things that is done in a great many states across the country, and that we think makes sense to adopt in California, is to have the voter registration system modernized so that people can actually register to vote on election day through use of a statewide voter database that we're hoping to get upgraded here in California.
Oh, wow. What is the process to get that done?
It's a process called same-day voter registration, and it's been implemented, as I say, in something like a dozen states across the country. And it allows our election results to be more accurate by making sure that people's votes don't count simply because there's been some glitch in their registration process or they've moved recently prior to an election.
Will that be achieved by just a technical thing, or has that got to be voted on?
No, there's a bill moving in the California state legislature to adopt that via policy change.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds good.
Yeah, and that's something Common Cause has been working on, and folks could go to commoncause.org/California to find out more about that.
Oh, good. Yeah, and something that always gets under my bonnet, is the Electoral College. Anything afoot to equalize that system? I really grind my teeth when I know I'm only worth a quarter of the vote of somebody in Wyoming.
Yeah, there is a growing movement that's behind something called the National Popular Vote Plan. California has joined this plan, as have about half the states that comprise the Electoral College. It's a state-by-state system that, if fully implemented, would guarantee that whoever won the most votes in all 50 states would be elected to the president's. And so that would guarantee that every person's vote is equal, which is, you know, the way we all think it ought to be.
I imagine there's a lot of sparsely populated states who'll be up in arms about it.
You know, it turns out not so much. The real advantage right now goes to the quote-unquote swing states that get all the attention, you know, Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, which actually tend to be fairly large states. So places where this has passed already include smaller populated states like Vermont, Rhode Island, et cetera. So it doesn't always break down the way people think it does.
Oh, interesting. Now, yeah, you're talking about those basically battleground states. They're the ones that really make the difference in an election, and where most of the candidates, I don't know at what percentage, how many they're considered, how many states are considered that, and how much, what percentage they put in there. Do you have any idea on that?
Well, it's really only about 10 or 12 states in a presidential election that are considered to be the battleground. And really, by the end of the race in October, there are usually only five or six states that are really considered hotly contested. And candidates spend the vast majority of their money and their time visiting in those states, polling in those states, and tailoring their policies to the voters in those states and really ignoring states, you know, big like California and small like Hawaii. So that's why we think that change makes sense with the National Popular Vote Plan.
Now, of course, we're on the radio here, and I understand that the National Association of Broadcasters have quite a bit of influence in this whole process. Can you tell us something about them and what's been happening with them?
Sure. The National Association of Broadcasters are a very powerful lobby. Both, you know, they have money to spend and lobbyists to hire, but also members of Congress are very fearful about crossing their local broadcasters for fear that they won't get put on TV. And these are, of course, some of the biggest beneficiaries of all this money that's flowing in our political process, because most of that money goes to buy TV ads. So that their profit margins spike tremendously during campaign seasons. And so they don't really have any financial interest in getting rid of all this big money.
Whoa, nice little systems going around here.
Yes, indeed. These are the problems we're up against. And that's why, you know, it's all the more important that people get involved. You know, we have had, similar problems in the past in our country, right? We didn't used to let women vote. We used to have slavery in this country. We did used to have a poll tax. And we've solved those problems, and I think we can overcome these as well, and that's what the Amend 2012 campaign is about. So I'd really encourage folks to go check out that website, amend2012.org, and get involved, because this stuff is just too important to sit idly by and watch our democracy get wasted away.
Yeah, we can go on about our freedoms and liberties, but there's a way to help.
Yeah.
And is there any events coming up to get things going, any rallies or special things?
You know, I am expecting that there's going to be rallies organized around this ruling that I just mentioned just happened today, where the Supreme Court of the United States struck down this Montana law that had been on the books for over 100 years. I'm not quite sure what the date will be of those rallies. I think they may wind up springing up organically, but if people keep their eyes on that amend2012.org website, we'll be posting information there as it comes.
Excellent. And just as a final overview, what, say, over the next 5 years, what would you like to see achieved to get bring that fairness and equality to this system?
Well, I'd like to see us pass a constitutional amendment that allows for limits to be set on how much any person can spend on political campaigns. Mm-hmm. I'd like us to see us pass that greater disclosure that we were talking about earlier, so people know who's spending the money and how much. Mm-hmm. And I think we also need a system of public financing of campaigns that allows candidates, if they want to run for office without taking a dime of private money. And that's a system that's already passed in a number of states and we could be moving forward with at the federal level. Indeed, we got a lot of work in front of us, but you know, when things do change, oftentimes change happens very quickly and can be pretty dynamic. So I think we may be entering a period of history that's like that.
Well, we certainly last year was certainly like that. Hadn't seen many years like that.
Indeed, these are interesting times in America.
Indeed, and well, thank you very much, Derek Cressman of Common Cords. I think you're keeping it interesting and keeping us aware and alert, and I do hope everyone goes to amend2012.org.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Derek.
All right, bye. Bye.